Coming up next on 94.7 WTBC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to the show, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio, and I like to say Persistence Radio. On the show today, which we air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, wanted to say that I am Ellen Daniels, and my co-host is Nancy Lawrence. I am in Charlottesville. Nancy is in our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're talking with investigative journalist and author Hawes Spencer about his new book, Summer of Hate. Hawes is a freelance investigative reporter whose pieces have appeared in the New York Times and many others. And we've got Indivisible Charlottesville's Ken Horn to ramp us up and tell us just why the election is so important. We'll discuss the 5th Congressional District race, Leslie Coburn, Denver Riggleman, three easy things you can do before November 6th to help save our democracy, and much more. In just a year and a half, we have spoken to over 120 fascinating, talented guests like these about everything from the rise of fascism to the life of bees, from Black Twitter to the refugee crisis, from soul food to how to make a balanced cocktail, and so much more. Check out all our podcasts. You can download them at 947wpvc.org. Now, my friend, Nancy, are you there?
Ellen.
All right.
I'm here. Guess how many more shopping days till the midterms?
How many?
Three.
Yes.
That's it.
And we're going to hear
more shopping days, and then we can get back to the war on Christmas. But right now, the war on democracy does truly rage.
Yes, we're going to talk all about that. I wanted to update everyone about the Albemarle School Board meetings and stuff. Just a little bit about that. Our friend of the show, Lara Harrison, was one of six arrested this August. I can't even believe I'm saying these words, really, when you know of like what really happened there. But her charges were dropped. I think they were deemed unconstitutional. Yet there's no recourse for those officers, and the other charges seem to me entirely bogus.
It did seem bogus. I'm actually surprised it moved along that quickly, you know, considering.
Yeah. Well, there's some other stuff happening with that. I'm not going to get into it just for legal reasons. But on the good news part of this is that in a show of solidarity, but mostly common sense, the Charlottesville City School Board unanimously voted to ban students from wearing Confederate imagery clothing and Nazi clothing, white nationalist groups kinds of stuff.
So they finally decided. That's great.
Jeez. Well, the other school board, not Albemarle. This is
right,
Charlottesville. Oh, okay, yeah. So there's a little bit of a difference there.
Well, so, you know, as long as something good is invading the fashion trends, as opposed to this reprehensible lie of an invasion down at the border, the military. It's unbelievable. Anyway, okay. I know we must move on.
Yeah, so the film festival is going on this week in terms of events, and I'm going to see also good friend of the show, Larisha Hawkins, is in the movie Same God tonight at PVCC at 8:30. Of course, she was involved in the controversy at Wheaton College because she dared to wear a hijab in solidarity with Muslims, and she is going to be, I think she's touring the country. There have been premieres in L.A. and Chicago, so I'm excited for that film.
That sounds very cool. I have a national one, another November 6th marker, the deadline to make a public comment opposing the indefinite detention of immigrant families down at the border is also November 6th. All you have to do is go to stopfamilydetention.org and just, you know, say, you know, I want families to belong together. That's it. You know, but if you can do that before November 6th, you can make a public comment and get your voice heard that way as well.
That's fantastic. So let's move on because we have so much to talk about with our next guests. Our first guest is Haas Spencer. He is an investigative journalist and author of the new book, Summer of Hate. It details the events leading up to and following August 11th and 12th, 2017 in Charlottesville. And one aspect that I really appreciate is that it weaves in relevant history as a backdrop to shed light on what happened and why, from the demolition of the African-American neighborhood in Vinegar Hill to massive resistance and current actions or inactions by the University of Virginia. He tells a boots-on-the-ground story from perspectives of activists on the left and the right, and everyone else involved, or many other people involved. It's been called unbiased and probing, and Slate's Dahlia Lithwick calls it scrupulously careful reporting of the facts and a very detailed tableau of just what happened. Haas has reported for the New York Times, Washington Post, Time Magazine, and many others. He also helped found Seville Weekly and The Hook. Welcome to the show, Haas.
Ellen, thank you for having me here.
Yes. So you were there for everything, I know. The first clashes, the removing of the statue, all that stuff. You were there minutes after Fields rammed his car into the crowd, killing Heather Heyer. So what compelled you to write this book and to be at all those events?
The University of Virginia Press decided that there needed to be a concise and unbiased history of these events. And so they came to me and said, would I do it? And I said, yes, I would, because the world was watching, and it was important to have a straightforward and dispassionate account of what happened, because people feel so strongly about these events, and sometimes in their vehemence about the importance of them, they start cutting corners on factual accounts. And so if I could give the world a very clear and clean account, then the arguments can move from there.
So, Haas, how difficult was it for you? I know you're an investigative journalist, but how difficult was it for you to get people to speak freely, openly with you?
It was generally not too hard, but one of the benefits I had was if someone didn't want to speak to me, there was usually so much that had already been said by that person that I could use what they had already said, and just as long as I cite the source. I mean, that's one of the standard journalistic devices that you, as long as you attribute, you really have the world is your oyster. You can quote from anywhere. So I didn't have to have anyone giving me a one-on-one interview. In fact, in most cases, I was more interested in the public pronouncements that people had made, because when you get one-on-one, sometimes people try to say, oh, well, I didn't mean that. And I was more interested in what they had said, because it wasn't always pretty, you know?
Well, then how did, how did you compile the, most of the research or all the research in your book?
You know, it was not that hard because, excuse me, I'm a radio reporter as my main work. I also teach college journalism classes from time to time. And in my radio work, I had done stories on all of these issues, and I've been in Charlottesville for 30 years, so I mean, just to give you a little sort of behind-the-scenes peek at what my work was, it was almost more like organizing work I had already done than vast amounts of new creative work. Putting this book together did take some time, because with a book-length project, you do have to organize it, and I tried to organize it a little bit like the Odyssey, the famous poem by Homer, where I kind of started with the dramatic action first and then dialed it back a little bit to give you the backstory.
So you, as I said, you were there. What was it like for you when you were at all those events?
You know, each one had its own form of craziness. I think one that stands out to me was probably the KKK rally on July 8th. And at that particular event, the most surprising thing to me was as the rally was ending and I walked up to High Street and tear gas was being fired, I looked down from what is now called Court Square Park. I think then it was called Jackson, and then it was called Justice Park.
Right.
But, you know, it's that little park by Charlottesville Court Square or Albemarle Court Square. And I looked down, and there were two of my three children standing there who felt compelled to come out and just see what it was all about. And I, at the time, I probably was woefully ignorant of the dangers. And so I was more intrigued that my two older teens were physically present than terrified for their safety. I was very glad that they didn't come out for August 12th, which was a considerably, as we all learned, a much more dangerous event.
Mm-hmm. Why did Richard Spencer choose to rally here, you know, in Charlottesville in the first place? And is that where it all went south? Not to lead the witness, sorry.
Yeah, Richard Spencer has referred to his Charlottesville events as Charlottesville 1.0, which is when he came here in May of 2017, Charlottesville 2.0, which was the Unite the Right rally, and then Charlottesville 3.0, which, if memory serves, was, I think, in October of last year, when he came back for, I guess, like a little flash demonstration. And we later learned he had a New York Times reporter embedded on his bus. And he says that it's important to stand up for white nationalism. He's been pretty clear on that and not ashamed of his position, which is widely regarded as a cover for some pernicious racism. And when I asked his president, who has since left his employment there, you know, how he intends to make America a whiter nation, they had no answer. And that's the thing that really scares people, because 20th century history is replete with examples of ethnic cleansing, which is such a cute little word, but it's really a euphemism for genocide.
And now he's been banned for 4 years, finally. What's your take on that?
You know, I guess my take on that is a little cynical. It's sort of like when Twitter and Facebook ban Alex Jones years after he told Sandy Hook parents that they were crisis actors. Like, are you really responding to the action, or are you responding to the public pressure? So that's my cynical take.
Mm-hmm. And so I need to back up and confess that I have not read The Odyssey, so this timeline of yours.
Yeah. Sorry.
Please.
I start
for those, you know, just me. Let's make it about me, who has not read The Odyssey.
You know, it's been about 40 years since I've read The Odyssey, so I could be remembering it wrong, but I sort of remember The Odyssey opened with Odysseus, his son Telemachus, fending off a bunch of suitors to the throne and the hand of his mother, which was, I guess, and then something very dramatic happened in that ballroom or banquet room in The Odyssey. I don't want to give it away for people who haven't read The Odyssey yet, but in a similar vein, and I hope, and I don't mean this to sound as jocular as it is, because I don't want it that way. It's obviously a very tragic event for the city of Charlottesville and for the individuals involved. But I did open with the terror on 4th Street. And maybe not in my very first chapter. I think my first chapter kind of tells you a little bit about Charlottesville, and then I go to the terror on 4th Street and try to look at that with a debunking kind of eye, where there were actually large swaths of people alleging that something happened on 4th Street other than what we were told happened. And even though I don't like to give a lot of credence to conspiracy theories, I tried to, in my telling of that tale, I tried to knock down any alternative facts or any alternative explanations for what occurred, because it was a well-documented event. I didn't see it with my eyes, but I've viewed many videos of what happened, and many still photographs. And I've conversed also with not just people who shot those videos, but with people who shot still photographs. And I was able to just look at it all, and tell you that what you saw on TV that day is what happened. You know, there's no real question about that.
Can you talk? I know in your book you go into James Field Jr. He has a very interesting past.
Yeah, he, you know, one of the, there's so many poignant little moments in this tale. To me, as a parent and as just a human being, I couldn't help but be a little torn by seeing his mother, who's confined to a wheelchair. She was confronted by reporters at her garage the night of, and you don't actually see her wheelchair, but if you know that she's in a wheelchair, it adds a little poignance to it. She said she's earnestly answering their questions about what her son was doing in Charlottesville, and she reveals that he had asked her to look after his cat, and that I should dial back, because your question was what was his background, and he was a troubled kid who expressed a lot of adulation of Adolf Hitler, mixed with an appreciation of Germany, and he had a high school teacher who was trying to extract those interests and help him see that you can be interested in Germany and recognize the horror of what Hitler did to that nation, and yet he seemed really unrepentant. He took a field trip to one of the death camps and said to one of his classmates, allegedly, "Well, this is where the magic happens." So not an appropriate kind of a thing to say, and worse, there was a pattern of 911 calls from his house by his mother where she was seeking assistance when he allegedly attacked her on numerous occasions, you know, threatened her with a knife, threatened to hurt her. And again, like I said, this woman is confined to a wheelchair and she's had a really tragic life. And the thing that I was going about earlier was she's answering these questions about what he was doing in Charlottesville, and she's a mom, and she probably, you know, had no idea that her son would do this thing, but he did.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of writing, did you always know you were going to be writing it as a book? I know the assignment came to you, but was it given to you as we'd like, you know, you to write a full book on it?
Yeah, it was like we have to have this history for students and educators and for any citizen of the world who wants to know what happened in Charlottesville. And the charge was really simple: just tell the facts. And so, I don't want to overemphasize what I did. And in some cases, I'm just compiling information. Like when I'm telling you about what happened with his mom being interviewed in Ohio, I wasn't there. I've just seen videos, and I looked at all the material I could look at. But you could have done that. Anybody probably could have done that. I was probably in a unique position in that I had been present at all the big Charlottesville events, the protests, the KKK, and having lived in Charlottesville and known people who lived in Vinegar Hill, I could tell some of that history with a little bit more awareness than somebody just kind of popping in. But I didn't do any magical interviews. There's no, like, you're not going to read this book and go, "Oh my gosh, he's got the smoking gun that we've never known. He's got the golden interview." It's not really like that. It's a very readable story telling what happened at a painful time in Virginia, Charlottesville, and American history.
Yeah, well, you talk about not having a smoking gun. Well, isn't that how history reveals itself? I mean, all these things come together to create a situation happens because on the heels of so much, whether it's, you know, slavery, other things.
Yeah, I don't know, but I mean, I'm not anticipating any huge surprises, but later this month, we're going to have a murder trial here in Charlottesville of James Alex Fields Jr. Mm-hmm. And so there will be revelations out of that, and there will be maybe some surprise witnesses, but I don't think for all the headlines that come out of that trial, I don't think we're going to have a new, an entirely new view of what happened.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're talking with journalist and author Hawes Spencer about his new book, Summer of Hate. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday at 10 a.m. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking right now with author Hawes Spencer about his book, Summer of Hate. And in just a little while, we're going to talk with Charlottesville's indivisible Ken Horn. So, question for you, Hawes. What are the misconceptions that you think people have about all of these events?
There's probably a lot of misconceptions. I think, you know, the governor had a misconception early on where he was accusing the governor was accusing the Unite the Right people of wielding bigger guns than the state had. But those people were not really of the Unite the Right. Those were the militias, which, you know, we can certainly scrutinize the militias for carrying weapons. But they were by and large not the Richard Spencers, not the Jason Kesslers, not the Baked Alaskas. So that's who it was. Militias who were carrying the guns, and they ended up signing consent decrees not to come back to Charlottesville because it did scare people to have so much firepower. You know, one of the things we're going to maybe hear at trial later this month of James Alex Fields, or in the first week of December. Is the left-wing militia man who sort of mouthed off after the fact that he scared James Fields out of the area with his own high-powered rifle, and whether that was a factor. I'm a little skeptical that whatever interaction he had with James Alex Fields had any bearing on Fields' ultimate decision to speed that car down 4th Street, but we'll have to see about that. Other misconceptions, you know, there was a lot of bad behavior on both sides. People throwing things, people gassing people in the face, people just behaving really badly. And it was one of the things that I found distasteful about this whole incident was, there's some really wonderful, activists and, people who have been protesting, but there's some pretty nasty people out there too. So again, I shouldn't call a person nasty, but I saw behaviors with my own eyes and on video that you just wouldn't contemplate civilized people committing. And that's why I was so pleased that my kids did not turn out to look at August 12th, because it was such a dangerous situation. And I'll tell you this, like, I personally stood there on Market Street Park, which I guess at that moment was called Emancipation Park, and I just wouldn't get down on the Market Street because I was so scared of having my eye poked out by a pole or something. And it was just hand-to-hand war for so long, and I just couldn't believe the police didn't intervene. But I've heard reasons since then why they didn't intervene. Some of them were structural, where they had organizational plans that conflicted with one another. And Tim Hafey brought this out in the so-called Hafey Report, the city commissioned after action analysis of what went wrong. And then also, when you think about arresting people, I'm not even sure if I got this in the book, but I'll say it here. It takes a handful of people to arrest one person. And so you wonder if this is what maybe people can debate. Like, if they had arrested one person and then, you know, might have taken six officers to pin that person down, handcuff them, transport them, would that have stopped some of the subsequent violence? Would that have been worth it? Or would that have taken six officers out of commission who then wouldn't be available to, arrest others? So reasonable people can argue these points, and I'm not sure I have a clean answer for you on that one.
But if they weren't doing enough, then they're stopping themselves from doing not enough. You know what I mean?
Right. They're taking themselves out of commission from doing nothing.
Right.
Yeah, I think one of the most painful things for people to watch was the inaction of the law enforcement. And it goes both ways. Like in the Hafey report, he quoted a veteran Charlottesville police officer who actually investigated the Hannah Graham and Morgan Harrington cases, saying we were standing there with our thumbs up our beep, and we felt hamstrung or something to that effect.
Well, certainly, I mean, setting the tone on Friday night when they walked around with those tiki torches like they owned the place, I didn't sense, I know I didn't see as much footage as you, but I didn't sense there were cops, you know, concerned with any of that. To me, that certainly set up whatever they did the next day, to me.
Right. There was exactly one arrest on Friday night. And the university did have a ban on fire already. And look what happened in the aftermath. Now the lawn is considered a facility. And if you wanted to have a cute little bake sale there, or, you know, put a stand around protesting a war or something with more than a minimal number of people, you couldn't do it. Or you'd have to plan it so far in advance that you might not want to do it anymore. So look at what we've lost since then. We've lost the freedom to assemble on the UVA lawn because the University Board of Visitors felt like it had to stand up and declare its lawn a facility. And we want to protect the lawn and we want to protect people and we don't want torches and open flame out there. But at the same time, we're giving up. It's sort of like, remember the Patriot Act from 15 years ago or whatever it was when we said, oh yeah, we'll just give up all of our freedoms in the name of fighting terrorism. And look, that's what's happening in Charlottesville. We've given away the openness of the University of Virginia.
What do you think has impacted you the most, having gone through all of this and the writing of the book as well?
I haven't been impacted at all. I mean, I've seen...
Really?
Yeah.
That is a statement that I thought you were kidding.
No, I'm not kidding at all. I mean, because think about it. Like, I've sat down with people who have had their lives physically horribly harmed, but I haven't been affected.
But I mean, besides what actually has happened to you, the facts, what about your thoughts and beliefs and opinions?
I guess I'm woefully unaware of how I've changed. I don't think I've changed. I've been touched by the people who I've met with and who feel that they have found a mission in playing a role in these events. But those are the stories. You know, the journalist wants to fade into the background. The journalist is not the story. It's the people who are out there fighting the fight. And I'm always impressed with those people. And I'm not even going to limit it to people on the left. You know, like if there's somebody on the right, I don't totally discount what they say. Some of them I might, but some others might have something interesting to say. Like, supposedly this whole thing started over a fight over a statue. And I know that there are people who are interested in the statues who are not crazy racists. There's some people who just like statues. And
or they don't really want to understand more. I mean, that's my opinion. But I do want to rephrase the question. Mm-hmm. Have you learned anything?
Oh, I've learned a lot.
Okay, let's get to
that. Yeah, like I think we're on radio, so people can't see me, but I'm like a really like pale white looking dude. And I went to a suburban Richmond school, and either I missed the day that we studied Jim Crow or I was tuned out. But I have learned how the statues were put up in the Jim Crow era and how they were manifestations of white supremacy. And not only that, but like one of the things that's really struck me as a white person or just as a human being is how much wealth white people have compared to black people. And I think you can trace a lot of it back to slavery. And so it's like Faulkner had that famous quote, William Faulkner, like, history isn't dead, it isn't even past. I think that's what he said. I may have botched it. But, you know, we are so largely today still working on the Civil War. And how my ancestors enslaved people and sold them like cattle. And to ignore that history, you ignore that history at your own peril. And so that's been really remarkable. And we've seen, and it continues to play out. You saw it in that New York Times article just a couple of weeks ago where the Charlottesville City School System went under a microscope over how it may not give black students quite a fair shake.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, you see it in most states, a determination to suppress the vote, and it's always black people, minorities, people of color. So yeah, your book is so important that way in that it documents something and doesn't glorify one side or the other. It's a document, and it's, you know, what happened simply. And that's, I know we're running out of time. I was just curious, very quickly, from whom do you get the most criticism and or the most praise? I guess choose one. I know we're running out of time, but I'm just curious, what's been the reaction, I guess, to your book?
You know, one of the tragedies of books is that they're long and people are slow to read them. And even to this day, you don't get quite the impact you get when you do a one-day news article that someone can just quickly read. So I haven't gotten a ton of criticism for the book. It was one of the things that worried me and almost made me not want to do the book. I thought, as a white guy, am I really the right person to write this book? But I did eventually do it, obviously. And so this is going to sound self-serving, but I really haven't gotten any criticism. Maybe I'm in store for some. Who knows?
Well, thank you so much for being here, Hawes Spencer. I will say that in looking through the book, and the black and white pictures are kind of striking. It really is. This could become a definitive history of what happened very easily.
Well, that was the goal, I guess.
Yeah. So, thank you again for being here, Hawes Spencer, journalist and author of Summer of Hate.
Thank you, Ellen.
Yeah.
Let that be the only season, sir.
Yeah,
we look forward to your next book about some other
topic.
A happy spring.
Yeah.
A happy spring.
Eternal.
Yeah. So, Nance, you have a news or note for us?
I do. It is election themed. The first good piece of election news is, hopefully, anyway, Tim Owens, the treasurer for the independent candidate Greg Orman, running in Kansas for the governor's race. Tim Owens has resigned from his post because instead he's going to support the Democrat, Laura Kelly, saying electing Kris Kobach as governor is one of the worst things that could happen to our state. So he's withdrawing from his supporting the independent candidate.
Nice.
In Georgia, three good things, well, two, aside from Oprah helping Stacey Abrams out on Thursday. The federal court told Brian Kemp that he cannot reject absentee ballots for this whole signature mismatch thing. He can't do that. And he also tried to throw out 3,000 ballots from naturalized citizens in Georgia. He wrongly blocked them from registering, and the court told him he can't do that. And there are 200,000 people who have never voted in an election before who have cast a ballot in Texas. That is the second highest number of first-time voters, and from California being the most. And they, at that time, only had 78,000. So it's amazing how many people are now voting.
Wow, I'm so proud of you. Those were so positive.
I know, for once. I know, right? So, I have the other kind, but I chose not to.
Thank you. And I'll just add to that something that isn't new, but I just learned about it, that in Oregon, you're automatically registered to vote when you get or renew a driver's license or an ID card.
Wow.
So it's called the Motor Voter Law, enacted there in 2015. And also, I have to say, in Australia, it's against the law not to vote.
Hmm.
And you have to pay a fine if you don't vote.
Wow.
I know. Going to move there.
That's a good one.
I know.
We should just drop the mic. We should just have silence. So I know Ken's coming. That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
To hold our heads in shame. Okay.
So speaking of Ken is right here. He is from Indivisible Charlottesville. He is a steering committee member with them. He is an artist, father, clinical social worker, particularly concerned about the Trump administration's hate, corruption, and divisiveness. And he is here in part to spread the message to vote on November 6th. So welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show, Ken, I should say.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be back.
Yes, you know, you were here February, I believe, 11th or so, 2017, when things were just getting started with Indivisible.
Yep.
So what has been going on since there? What has changed for you since then?
Well, we've been working nonstop. I think what's changed for me is just getting a deeper understanding of a lot of the issues that are at stake. But our group has just grown and grown and grown. We are a national, we are a local chapter of a national group of, it's basically a citizen group that is standing up to the hatred, corruption, and division of the Trump administration and holding elected officials accountable. And here in Charlottesville, we have 5,000 plus members and volunteers that it's just been incredible to see the sustained organizing and enthusiasm to show up for all the kinds of rallies and events and canvassing and postcarding and all the different kinds of things we've been doing to increase voter turnout for this election.
You know, it was really the thing that, you know, I remember that day in when the meeting had to be moved from the library, a smaller space, to the Haven, a really large space, and like how we were so, you know, people were just as everyone I'm sure listening hopefully well knows what I mean, you just felt so helpless, hopeless, and so upset, really. And then there we were, like, we just wanted to do something, and you guys were there organizing and telling us to, you know, put in the phone numbers of our representatives in our phone. And I really appreciate, I definitely can't go to everything, but I see what you guys are doing, and I just want to say I really, really appreciate it. It's so needed here. So that's all. I just wanted to thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Nance.
Well, I was going to, Ellen, but I know you're going to cut me off because we have to go to a commercial.
Oh, thanks for reminding me. Okay, we have a hard break. I've got really into
But I go first.
You can go first. Okay. We'll be right back with Ken Horn. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We're here with Ken Horn from Indivisible Charlottesville. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
Ken, what have been some specific concerns to Virginia, like, is there gerrymandering? What's your map like? Do you have suppression coming from politicians as well?
Well, we're definitely a very gerrymandered district here in the 5th District. I think our district, people say that it's larger than the states of, like, New Jersey, or it stretches very far from the north all the way and kind of gets wider as it goes down to the south. But I would say there are a ton of issues that are extremely important to 5th District voters, health care being the first. Leslie Coburn, who is on the ballot as the Democrat in the election on Tuesday, stands for healthcare for everyone. She believes that every citizen of this district should be able to have accessible, affordable, quality healthcare. And her opponent, Denver Riggleman, the Republican, does not. He flat out stated in one of the recent debates that he does not believe that healthcare is a basic right. And so I would say healthcare, women's rights. Leslie believes in Planned Parenthood. She supports the Equal Rights Amendment. She believes that women should be able to make their own decisions about their health care and their bodies, that those are private decisions between individuals and doctors, and that the government should not be involved. She believes in racial justice, criminal justice reform, fair taxes for the middle class, climate justice. She's a huge environmentalist, really understands the pressing needs of global warming and the need to protect our air, water, our land. She's against the fracked gas pipelines that are running through our state and the two that are currently being built. And also gun reform. I would say common sense gun reform is a huge issue that she's standing up for and that her opponent, Denver Riggleman, is against.
You know, as at the very beginning of her campaign, there was a very, really vicious rumor about her being anti-Semitic. So I don't know if you can speak to that or not, but if you can, I'll say a tiny bit that I know.
Yeah, I just know that it's absolutely not true and that she has the support of the Jewish community, especially locally here in Charlottesville, I know, but throughout the district as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had read that too. And, you know, it just goes to show, I was a victim of believing it just for, even if it was just for a moment, without really looking up. I did eventually, of course, look up where it came from and all that, but that stuff is so harmful.
Yeah, and I think the Republicans are grasping for straws. I mean, they are desperate to try to frame her negatively, and they're not talking about the issues, whereas she is talking about the issues that matter to the citizens of this district. Like I said, healthcare, mm-hmm. you know.
Yes, just to deflect, another way to deflect.
Exactly.
And I listened to Obama's speech, I think it was in Wisconsin, and he really came out strongly about saying that how, at least, I think it's there, I don't know if it's federal, but there's a lawsuit against allowing or having the whole pre-existing condition thing, and that a lot of people around the country, Republicans, are saying they're that pre-existing conditions, that you won't be penalized for them, when it's actually, he called it out as a lie, and they're actually suing for that legislation against people with pre-existing conditions. So it's just amazing how people are becoming just so bold-faced about lying these days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's terrible. I think what I really want people to understand is that on Tuesday, we are voting on, I mean, on so many issues, but as far as healthcare, you know, basically every family, everyone I know, someone in a family or an extended family has a pre-existing condition. And I want everybody to know that if you're concerned about healthcare, if you have pre-existing conditions in your family, Leslie Coburn is the person to vote for, because she believes in healthcare for everybody and even moving towards Medicare for all system.
And how have people been responding to her message?
Oh, the enthusiasm has been incredible. There was a rally just this week, the other night, with Leslie and Tim Kaine over at Champion Brewery in Charlottesville. It was a huge crowd outside pouring off their patio. So much enthusiasm. And that's happening throughout the country. I was listening to Gloria Steinem last night on TV, and she was saying that even compared to her activism in the feminist movement in the 60s and 70s, it was nothing like it is now. And you know, the host was like, really? And she's like, absolutely. Maybe a third of the country was involved back then, but now it's a majority that is standing up to the divisive and corrupt and racist Trump agenda and enthused to show up at the polls. And I think those early voting stats are really showing that.
What is part, well, I know there's only 3 days left, but what has been and what is left of your Flip the Fifth strategy? Share with us all the stuff you guys are doing.
Yes, so that is the most important thing right now in these final days. We have a lot going on every single day, all day today, tomorrow, and Monday. There are opportunities, and we just really want to encourage people to come out and help us. There are canvassing opportunities where you go knock on doors, talk to voters face to face. It's one of the most influential ways to get people to show up at the polls. And those shifts are taking place, like I said, every day over the next few days, at 9 a.m., and then again at 12 noon, and then again at 3 p.m., and then again at 6 p.m. So there are four shift opportunities to come out, knock doors, but you can also do phone banking. And I would say in the final days, those are the two main strategies that we're working on. There's some text banking as well. We just got finished with a huge postcard campaign. We sent over 27,000 postcards to folks in the district who lean Democrat but don't always show up. And we just had an incredible response to that campaign from our members and volunteers. And I do want to give a quick shout out to just all of our members and volunteers who just show up consistently and put so much time and effort and enthusiasm into this work of Flipping the Fifth and getting out the vote on November 2nd.
You also had a Vote With Me app. What was that? Or what is that, if it's still applicable?
I want to correct. I just said November 2nd, and I meant November 6th.
So, you're right.
Excuse me. I'm actually not sure about that app.
Okay.
I haven't used
that
myself.
Okay, and what about the Car2Vote thing you're talking about, getting people to the polls?
Yeah, Car2Vote is an incredible organization locally that helps with voter transportation to the polls. So if you or anybody that you know has trouble with transportation, needs transportation, maybe is struggling with a disability, we definitely want people to be accessing Car2Vote. So what you do, if you need any help getting to the polls on Tuesday, you're going to call this number. It's 434- 434-260-1547. Again, 434-260-1547, and you can make a plan. They also have a website, and you can fill out a need a ride form on there, and that's www.car2vote.weebly.com, and Weebly is W-E-E-B-L-Y.
And the whole idea of the state being so gerrymandered, I learned this from the last, those elections that came up in the middle, you know, and whatever they were, not at the midterms or the general, you guys, people really need to show up because it's so impossible for the majority to reveal itself as far as on the House floor. Is that right? Still, that's the way it is there.
Absolutely. I mean, every single vote counts. And this district is gerrymandered to kind of erase the Charlottesville Albemarle vote because we know this is a kind of Democratic progressive place. But we are not going to let that happen this time. And Trump won the 2016 election by like 10 or 11 points. And what Leslie Coburn has done, she's been on the ground organizing throughout the district for over a year, and she has made up that gap. So the race is now neck and neck. She's made up 10, 11 points, and now it's neck and neck. And some polls have actually put her ahead by a point or so. So we know in recent elections in Virginia that some elections come down to literally one vote. And we know that when Tom Perriello held this district, he won it by, I think, just a few hundred votes. So every single vote counts. It is not an option to not show up to vote for this election. We just need everybody to show up and talk to everybody you know. This is the other thing people can do is they can, you know, send an email to everyone in their network that lives in the district, to post on social media, post on Instagram, whatever platforms you use. Make sure that every single human being that you know is aware that there is a huge consequential election this coming Tuesday, November 6th.
And I bet you for everyone that there's one person out of 10, I'm just making that up, but in my experience that you're surprised is not going to vote or saying that they're not going to vote. I did that with my family. I'm like, I just started to text everyone, got on a group text. And then one, my cousin was like, so-and-so, that's my goal to get her registered. I was like, what? You know, so, yeah. I mean, it is really important just to do maybe, I always think, say like one more thing than you would do, at least more than you have in the past.
Absolutely. And especially young folks, if you know, millennials or young folks that might not typically vote in a midterm election, we really want to make sure those folks understand that as a voting bloc, they have so much power. And we just want to encourage them to get out there and participate.
How difficult is it to register in Virginia to vote?
You know, I wish it was better. I would love to see some of the stuff going on out west and in Oregon happening here. I think I would prefer that we have same day voter registration, that, you know, I think, I don't know the ins and outs of how Virginia compares to other states. But I know that there's a cutoff date, you know, ahead of the election. And if you miss your opportunity, you miss it. So I think that we should remove all barriers. I mean, what the Republican Party has been doing, the attacks on voting rights, the attacks on minority groups, whether it's African Americans, what's going on in Georgia or the Native American communities in the Dakotas, it's unconscionable what's happening. And it's ridiculous that in 2018, in a so-called democracy, that this kind of stuff is taking place. And that's why we have to vote progressive. We have to vote Democratic. We have to vote for Leslie Coburn on November 6th, because these issues she deeply understands, and she will fight for voting rights.
Yeah, I'm appreciative.
You find that young people... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was wondering, are you finding, because you've now been entrenched in Indivisible for a while, that young people, I sound like a grandmother, are showing up at events or are showing up at volunteering events as well? Do you sense that demographic?
We see it. I wouldn't say it's our main demographic, but we work pretty closely sometimes with the university Democrats over at UVA. And through my other work, I mean, I think what we've done is we've tried to build coalitions and get involved in some local issues as well. And there are incredible groups like Surge, the Showing Up for Racial Justice group, the Hate Free Schools Coalition. And I would say you see some younger people involved or maybe higher percentages of younger people involved in some of those organizing efforts. But there are nice relationships and coalition building happening between some of these groups. And so we certainly do have all ages show up at our events. And we certainly work with folks of all ages on a range of issues in the community and in the district.
Well, I want to thank you for being here. Do you have any last words that you would like to say?
I just want to make sure that people show up on November 6th, and just, you know, the importance of a progressive agenda that serves the majority, and that we're working to demand that government works for all of us, not just the wealthy corporate elite.
Absolutely. You're speaking our language. Everyone go vote, and please just commit yourself. I'm going to ask if everyone just for me, could you do for me, for all of us, actually, just do one more thing. That it could be just a text. It could be social media. Could be going out to a school board meeting, but actually with the intent of getting people out to vote.
Yeah, can I say where the campaign office is?
Please, please.
On your stuff, Ken, that polls are open from 6 to 7, 6 a.m., 7 p.m.
Yeah. Ken wants to say one more thing.
That's right. And canvassing opportunities all day today, tomorrow, and Monday. And the Coburn campaign office is in Ix Art Park. It's at 937 2nd Street Southeast by Brazos Tacos. And just show up there. If you're not sure, just show up and help out.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. So people can just show up at our office near Ix.
Yes.
Find it. And she'll put you to work.
They'll put you right to work. Okay. And we would love to meet you and work with you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for all the work you're doing and have been doing for all this time.
Thank you for this show.
Yeah, thanks.
She's a blue wave.
Yeah. So, Nance, you know what it's time for?
Yes, but I need the audio cue.
There you go. There's your audio. Go ahead.
Am I going first?
It's a palate cleanser time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. All right. Mine's related. I'm doing a theme. In 1881... Anthony Baranek of Chicago patented the very first voting apparatus, US 248130A. That was a patent. It was appropriate for the US. It was the first one used in the US general election, this apparatus. It offered an array of push buttons. There was a row across for the office and a row down for the party. And you, an interlocking mechanism behind so you could only vote for one candidate. And he claimed, by means of this device, all fraud is prevented and ballot box stuffing impossible. So hack that, Russia. Say to you.
Yes. Thanks for that. I wanted a little throwback to Halloween, which just happened not too long ago. I became aware that people are growing pumpkins in California as a hobby and trying to get the largest they can. These pumpkins are like 2,000 pounds. They're the size of a smart car. So this guy raised a 2,100-pound pumpkin. It's a contest. He won like $15,000. Yeah, it's like $7 a pound. And there was a really interesting story about a guy named Leonardo. I'll get his name in a minute, but his last name. But he raised a pumpkin. And his story was that, like, he put so much time and care into getting the pumpkin to grow, because there's so many things that can go wrong. One of them is sunburn, which I didn't know about. But so much care and time that the wives of these pumpkin growers are called sometimes pumpkin widows, because they're left at home while these guys are in the patch doing pumpkins. So, I don't know. It's just a really nice story about Leonardo and how he was really a credit to his agricultural wherever he was working, and they really appreciated his dedication. So
listen, you may be on to something. If you're telling me that pumpkins have some sort of skin irritation to the sun, this may be a way to reach climate change deniers if they're going to be denied their pumpkin spice latte because of the sun is too hot for the pumpkins. Ellen,
right?
Ellen,
I know.
You may be on to something, and so maybe Leonardo, the two of you. Sorry.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I was just really moved. It was a cute story about this guy. Anyway, you know, everyone, please vote November 6th and do a little bit more than you have been. No one has to do everything, but you have to vote. Everyone has to do something. Our music is by Springtide. Nancy, thanks for being with me all the time. I really appreciate you.
Absolutely.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.